Over a hill and under a misty mountain, deep within the unceded Musqueam territory of Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Doug Vandelay with another episode of Comedy Zeitgeist. You can follow the show on Twitter at Comedy Zeitgeist and pester me at Doug Vandelay. Hello to everybody listening on CITR 101.9 here for the first 30 minutes of the show. The host of a show with another subterranean-themed name, I'm here with Jackie Hoffart of Foxhole Comedy. How's it going, Jackie?
Pretty good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no worries. So just off the bat, how did you get started in comedy?
Ooh, that's a good question. The short answer is that I took a stand-up class through Instant Theater, which is one of those places where you can go for like 4 Sundays for an afternoon, and it's sort of you and 6 or 8 people workshopping your first 5 minutes, and then you finish the class with a show with everyone in the class's family and friends, so it's like the warmest audience ever, and then, yeah, you sort of take it from there. And so that's officially how I started. Unofficially, my confirmation speech in front of my church when I was like 12, I got a laugh right off the top, and I was like, oh, I like this. But it's not as though comedy is something that was like a linear path or even anything I would consider. I mean, there's days where I'm like, am I a comic? So, I don't know. Depends when you ask me, but.
So what was your journey from starting that to hosting Foxhole Comedy?
Maybe it would be more useful for me to kind of rewind a little bit, which is to say, I did a Teen Angst Night, which is a night that a comedy producer or a show producer, a theater producer, general fun person around town, Sarah Bino, hosts. And it's where you read your like teenage diaries. And I figured that would be a really safe way to start doing comedy because 2 reasons. One, you're reading. And 2, you have like an ironic distance from your material because though you wrote it as a child or a teenager. And so I started doing those and like just kept doing them because they were quite a lot of fun. And then I started doing storytelling shows. So like, I don't think they do the series anymore, but there was one called Rain City Chronicles for a few years, and it would be a lot like The Moth, where you had to tell a story without notes, specific time limit. And then that gave me the courage to go, okay, let's do stand-up. And like I said, I took that class, but then I just sort of very slowly, like over the course of a year, I probably went up like a dozen times maximum at different open mics and booked shows if I could get them, because even before I was in comedy, I had a lot of friends in comedy. And, you know, and then I used to work in film production, so I would sort of disappear off the earth for like 3 and 4 and 6 months at a time and then drop back in and try to do open mics like every night while I was off work to just have something to do. And so for several years I had phases of being more involved and interested and trying to book shows and work out material and then just kind of disappearing. Last year, so like 2017, a guy named Brent Constantine started a show. He runs Little Mountain Gallery with a bunch of other folks. And he, at the time, ran the show Foxhole Comedy out of the projection room at the Fox, which is this much smaller venue above the cabaret that has about 30, 40 seats. And he ran that show without any like specific or particular theme or even anything particularly regular about the way, like the number of comics from week to week. I would say the only thing that was consistent about it, other than the fact that he did do it every week, was that it wasn't particularly well attended. So the Fox was very patient with him in him trying to build the audience. But at the same time, I think a bunch of other stuff was happening for Brent professionally, and I think he didn't really have the time to focus on it. And I was just always obsessed with that space. Like, I always really liked it. I loved going to the show. I loved being on the show. I would go when I wasn't on the show, which is always a good sign when a comic likes to go to a show that they're not on. And one day I just approached him and said, hey, you know, like I kind of knew him. I wouldn't say we were like friends, but I, you know, comedy friends. And I just asked him like, hey, you know, I love this space. Do you need any help with like social media? I can do your Instagram or something. Like, I just really want to, I find myself always wanting to know who's on the show, and it's a little difficult. There isn't much of a social media presence. And he was like, yeah, let me get back to you. Like, there's lots of changes happening. I appreciate the offer. I'll let you know. And then like a couple days later, he was like, so it turns out all the things that I had lined up for the show that I was thinking about have not panned out. So do you want to just take over the show? And I was like, yes, I will. And then he was like, do you want to start tomorrow? And I was like, okay. So yeah, so that's how it happened. He just handed me the show basically. And what I did was then, you know, obviously for a couple of weeks, it was still the people he'd booked. But then the only thing I really kept is the name and the space. Everything else I've completely changed. So I decided that if I was going to run a show, it was going to be, we don't really have like a good word for it, to be honest, but like marginalized voices led. But by marginalized, I also mean like women, anyone who is non-binary or any person of color, anybody who is otherwise or like queer or anything like that, just sort of basically just not the average guy in comedy, that those people were going to be privileged in terms of building the lineup. But like the reality is that I just have a cap on cisgendered heterosexual white men, which is every week I book no more than 2 out of a total of 8 performers who fit that exact category.
And it's sort of like the opposite of CanCon. You've got like 20%, 25% of...
I suppose so. Yeah. I mean, it's... Yeah.
Not the opposite, but it's a similar thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's stressful for people and also in some ways for myself to think of it as being like literally discriminatory in the sense that I'm discriminating the amount of people and the certain types of people based on identity markers that I'm allowing on the show. However, the reality is that the comedy scene is inaccessible for a lot of people for a lot of reasons. And a lot of those reasons have to do with the fact that it's essentially a formless, no experience required, barrier-free, in some ways, experience, which is to say anybody who feels entitled to do it entitles themselves to do it and just takes a stage and says what they want. And so you have to, as a person practicing it, which you have to do constantly, you have to put up with a lot of not just unfunny stuff. Like that's not even really the problem. As a practicing amateur comedian, you have to just put up with a lot of like racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, misogynist bullshit. And it really turns people off comedy. And so for me, I wanted to just not change all of that, but just make a dent in the spaces where people can do comedy. So that includes, so that's part of why the show is also all experience levels. So I always have basically a pro headliner, person who does 12 or 15 minutes at the end, and everybody else does 7 minutes each. And but I always have like one or two people who are very new or like pretty new to comedy. And then everyone else is just sort of varying levels in between and all ages too. And we've had a few celebrities, like it's, you know, we mix it up, but I've been really excited with how much it's sort of taken off with folks, especially I would say like under 30 queer-ish, or I don't know, just like the new generation, millennials basically, like people who are not interested in kind of the same old club comedy anymore. And again, while I don't prescribe what people say on my show, I do let people, especially guys that I maybe don't know that it's a feminist show, and that if, you know, they can steer clear of being bigoted for 7 minutes, they're welcome on the show. And if they do anything that's like not cool in my show or not allowed, then they don't come back. Or depending on what it is, I'll ask them to revise it or ask them to avoid that joke.
It's no different than curating any other kind of show in that respect.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the context of comedy, I feel like there's a fanatical obsession with one's freedom to do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And that is pretty, I mean, it's partially the beauty of the medium is that it's so formless in some ways. You can come up and talk about aliens for 7 minutes or you can be two people, you can be three people, there's no prescriptions except sometimes people find it offensive to be requested to steer clear of topics that may or may not be welcome in certain audiences. And I don't have a problem with that because their feelings, the people who object to that policy, are not the feelings I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about all the other people who basically don't like going to comedy because they find it all so offensive. And the reality is there's so much good comedy out there. There's so many really smart, really funny, wonderful people with life experiences and stories you don't often see in mainstream comedy because we've just privileged a certain sort of person for so long. But
and it's kind of inaccessible for those kind of marginalized people to get into a lot of regular shows, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is and it isn't. It's like, you know, again, it's this case of like, like with so many professions, and especially in the arts, there's just this sort of boys club at the top, and which is not to say that there aren't women who also uphold this sort of status quo, but most women in comedy who have careers in comedy have had to like toughen up or whatever, develop a tough skin. And while that's important in some ways, I think there's a lot of beauty in being soft or being not tough. And I think that there's a lot of like humor and possibility for the magic that comes with storytelling, which is what comedy is, through and not being people who have to sort of calcify themselves to withstanding or hearing other comics or comedy or content that is knowingly or unknowingly really marginalizing. Like, I don't think people should have to go through that to develop as comics. And so any intervention I can make is like throwing my own little, like, not that it was that much long ago or that I was that young, but throwing my little queer self like a bone, just saying like,
yeah,
there's going to be space for you, but you're going to also have to make it.
But I really had this attitude across all mediums that you have to suffer for art.
Or worse yet,
Elvin, you do have to, but
yeah, you have to work hard. That's
it's
one
not
thing.
A prerequisite. Like, you can be a happy artist.
Yeah, but you don't have to suffer fools, basically, and I think that's the difference. So, I mean, we can talk about what it, you know, the steps it takes to build a career in a traditional sense in comedy. That's not even something that I do. Like, I have a full time job doing other things, and comedy is, for reasons, but also for good reasons, basically something that I do as my artistic outlet on the side. It's my side pancake, as my good friend Katie Stewart would say. She has like a whole essay about side pancakes and how that's
like an IHOP thing.
Yeah, as in like every time you get a breakfast, you should always get a side pancake. Like, and that, like in your life, you should always like, sometimes you have to think of, especially in a city like Vancouver, you have to think of your artistic practice as the side pancake.
This is my side pancake right here.
Exactly. Yeah. So Fuxhole's my side pancake. But am I allowed to swear?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I fucking love it. Like, it's really, truly my favorite thing. And honestly, if I kind of never do anything else in comedy other than run this show, even if it changes venues or whatever, but if I can keep running a weekly show, it's my favorite thing. And for lots of reasons. One, it's amazing to see people who basically feel alienated by the mainstream. I don't want to say it like there's one big group of people. It's a lot like high school. It's a bunch of people who have almost nothing in common. There is no like single characteristic that connects everyone in stand-up. There really isn't. And so, you know, for me at least, it's an opportunity for me to cross paths with people I don't otherwise meet in my life. I don't necessarily encounter in my work or in my social life or in my extended family or other hobbies, as if I had any. It's people who like feel really passionately about things maybe that you totally disagree with. And when you're in that space together trying to negotiate towards a mutually exclusive but common goal of bettering your comedy and like getting more chances, it's really competitive and like everyone's really insecure. I mean, I suppose that might be the only thing that connects everyone, although there are some super confident, maybe too confident comics out there, but you get in trouble for slagging other comics. I don't have a lot of filters, so.
We could talk about that stuff later as well when the mics are off.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. to the long-standing support from the Ring of Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Anyway, I lost my trail, but it's lovely seeing. Basically, there's a couple comics coming up now who I saw on other shows and invited onto mine, referred to me through people who knew about the show and thought that those other folks might like the show, and then I've just like really invited them on as often as I can, and because of course most of comedy booking is just asking for a spot and being granted one, and so other than open mics, and so and women, and especially women of color tend to ask less, feel less entitled to just get a spot just for asking, and so you often have to, as a producer, reach out to people and constantly find people, and I struggle with keeping the show as diverse as I would like it to be. Like, even for a show with a dude cap, there's still a lot of room to grow. But nevertheless, there's a few comics who've kind of really, I would say, come up through not just my room, but also another couple rooms in the show. Another one called Goldie's Comedy Basement is run by this awesome woman named Susie. She has like similar politics, but is a little bit more open. Like, her room doesn't have any caps or anything on it, and she casts a wider net, but she runs two shows a week and she's very busy. But anyway, seeing people grow, like even in 6 months or 8 months since we've been doing the show, or I guess it's like, well, it's more than that now, but it's gratifying. Like, it feels, I don't know, it feels like a piece of comedy that I really like, which is hosting and producing, which is actually very different from just doing material. That's kind of where I'm at. I really love this show.
Yeah, it's really good to see, and it's I think it is at least 10 months old. I think I went to one.
September is when we started, right? And what is it now? I don't know if this is supposed to be timeless, but like basically it's seven,
it's like
8, 9, 10.
It's June now.
We're coming up on a year, let's say.
When people are listening to this, it's going to be next week.
Cool.
So, or you know, whenever they find it, you know.
If we did
2027
math, like our parents would have, we could have cracked this nut ages ago. But
we don't need that. We got calculators everywhere. I've got a calculator
I think it
was on my
wrist. A baby ago, basically.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah,
just one full gestation period.
Exactly.
So I understand you founded Sad Magazine.
No, that is not accurate. Not founded. Oh, my God, no. No, but I was...
I heard that on the Sadcast podcast.
No, I founded Sadcast, the Sad Mag
podcast.
Okay,
that's my mistake.
Oh, my God. That's so flattering, though. No, a couple of folks who did the publishing program at SFU founded Sad Mag, I want to say almost 10 years ago. It could be 10 years ago. Or almost 10 years ago, maybe. And then they handed it off at some point to a friend of mine, Katie Stewart, who is still involved with it, although I would say it's moved on to its next iteration now. But it's a printed magazine, like a published, beautiful magazine that focuses on helping emerging artists and writers talk about arts and culture in Vancouver, and it only uses film photography. It's the best. And they're really scrappy and have like really done great work applying for grants and like having a board, and like it's real legit and cool, and I love them. So I was the co-editor-in-chief for a few years of the print mag, and then I kind of was like working in film a lot and just wanted to sort of move on from that, and I wanted to start sort of finding my voice a little bit more, which is an elusive journey. And I figured podcasting would be a good way to try that. And it seemed like a good time to launch a podcast. And so Katie was like, go for it. And so I just started Sadcast. And initially there was like one format, and then that was logistically difficult for me to work, like have that person come to my place and record weekly, which is I think what we initially were trying to do. And then it shifted into something slightly different, and then it morphed into something else. And then I was like, this is too much. I'm tired. Pass it on. So it now lives with someone else who's done a really great job with it and simplified it. And it's become this beautiful, I want to say monthly podcast where she does, Pam, the creative director of the magazine now and also the main designer, interviews creatives from Vancouver, like of all kinds of different genre. So I did start it. If you go back in the records of it, you can hear my favorite episode, which is just me talking to my phone or my iPad, probably trying to stay awake while on a road trip by myself. Just me talking to myself, trying to stay awake.
Yeah, I think we've all been there.
I'm also joking. It's terrible, but I think it's funny. But it wasn't really like on brand, and I was just like, okay, someone else should take this over.
So you work at Push International Arts Festival?
Push. Yeah, I work for Push. I'm the comms director there, which is my first like big girl job. And for 37, that feels about right. When I sort of transitioned out of working in film production, I moved into working in film festivals, which is really just like the fourth part of filmmaking, which is distribution. And so I worked at VIFF and at the Queer Film Festival and at DOXA. And then because DOXA shares an office with the Push Festival, I met a lot of the people at Push and kind of learned that it would be a cool place to work. And then when a job came up last fall, I applied and got it. And then this job came up while I was working there and applied and got it. And so I don't come from a theater or performing arts background, except for comedy, obviously, which is like the basement dwelling child of the performing arts. And
I think it takes a lot more courage than a lot of other performing arts.
I mean, it is a pretty punishing storytelling medium, but I mean, courage is... Well, I just feel I'm definitely part of the group of people who think there's nothing... Like, it's brave to be a refugee in 2018. Like, it's not brave to do stand-up comedy.
Yeah, I guess it's a sliding scale.
Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, most comics don't really mind that people look down on it. I mean, what's exciting is that there's a campaign right now to have the government recognize it as an art form with a positive contribution to the culture, such that it would then also qualify for grants through the Canada Council, which would be amazing. And people could like unionize. Although having had experience unwittingly self-nominating as the HR department of the comedy scene, I will say organizing comics is probably going to be interesting. Someone should make that documentary. But
sounds like you just volunteered.
Yeah, I don't know. No thanks.
No volunteering for you?
No, yeah. I'm good. It's too much drama, honestly.
Yeah. God, I can't imagine running a guild.
Push, right. Yeah. Anyway, so no experience in the performing arts, just kind of movie background. But obviously, I mean, professionally, I've had many lives. So I used to work at a newspaper, and then there's Sad Mag, and then I like worked in the UK and in marketing at a big... grocery store. Maybe you've heard of Waitrose. I worked in their communications department. And so communications didn't come out of nowhere for me, but performing arts did. And so Push, if you're not familiar, is like actually the coolest fucking festival. Sorry, I'm like not fully eating my nib. Spitting nibs.
It's a running theme on this show.
That's probably why there's a big... It's brave of you to serve nibs during a podcast recording.
It started to generate content. Like last week, I dropped some on the floor. It's the same bag of nibs. We're just like doling out a little bit. This is actually the last of it. Maybe we won't renew this one, but I just love them.
Yeah, me too.
Can't get them.
My wife doesn't like them, and I'm like, oof.
More for you.
You're wrong. Yeah. Yeah. She also doesn't like avocados, which is also like...
That's weird.
It's really weird. I was like, ooh, can we get married? I don't know. But I went with yes for other reasons. But... Anyway, Push Festival, it's really rad. It's multidisciplinary, so it's not like theater exactly, although there is theater in it. It's kind of like, it's three-ish weeks of a bunch of different performances by different people. I want to say the majority of whom are not, who are international or from other cities, and then like a solid chunk that are also local. And I have heard it called the Sundance of Performing Arts Festivals. But I am also in the marketing committee slash, like, not committee, full-time job. But sorry, I'm so used to being in a co-op that everything is a committee. Yeah, so there's, like, weird dance and weird music and weird, I don't know, like, kind of cabaret style and just, like, animation and, like, live folk. Just everything is kind of strange and interesting. And so I really recommend checking it out, especially if you're under 25. We have, like, $5 rush tickets, which is insane because these things normally cost, like, 40, 50, 60 bucks. So, yeah, push is cool.
At 2 or 10?
Yeah.
And when's the festival on?
January.
All right.
A big so lead time.
Just missed that one?
Yeah. Well, it comes around again next year. 15th anniversary. It'll be great.
So you work for the Japan Times as well?
Yeah.
Did you live in Tokyo while you were there?
I lived in Japan for 4 years. I left right after graduating university with the plan of only staying a year. And then I sort of kicked and screamed. I had a long-distance relationship that was like, so I was emotionally like not really present for the majority of the time that I was there. And then recontracting time came around and I was like, nah, I'm leaving. I want to go back and whatever. And then me and my long-distance partner, were we girlfriends? I don't know. Anyway, there was heartbreak. And then I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to stay. So I started learning Japanese a lot more, started paying more attention to my classes, making Japanese friends. And so I stayed 2 years in this cool town that I was, it's technically a city, but it felt more like a town to me, called Onomichi in Hiroshima Prefecture. And then I spent, then I was also thinking of leaving. Then I fell in love with someone and then we moved to Tokyo. And then I got a job at an English language daily newspaper there called the Japan Times. And I stayed there for 2 years. Then we moved to London.
And then back to here?
And then back to Vancouver. Then did we broke up and then we moved back and then I moved back to Vancouver.
Did you pursue comedy at all while you were there or is that,
that
all
only,
recent years?
No, not really, because I was like, honestly, yeah, I think, you know, the past, 12 years of my life is like a really long case study in like refusing to decide what to do when I grow up. And so I just had my degree and all this debt and I was like, well, in Japan, they'll give you a fucking job right away, so I'll just go and do it, and it seems like it'll be cool or whatever. I wasn't particularly, like, a Japanophile, like, or whatever. Like,
I think weeabo is the current term.
Yeah, anyway, I had to make up a story when I lived in Japan, and people asked me, why did you come to Japan? I was like, well, this is partially true. My grade 7 teacher had also done the same program, and so when I was a kid, I had this notion that you could go and teach in Japan and that it was a really interesting place. But anyhow, there I was, and I found it really challenging. Like, I'm not the first person to, I don't know, I think if anyone says like, oh my god, it's the best place on earth and it's so rad and amazing and wonderful and the coolest, like, they've been on a holiday in Japan, which is true. But if you live there, especially as a non-Japanese person, and even as a Japanese person, it's a difficult place to live. But there's lots of, like, amazing, cool, beautiful, wonderful things also about Japan. There's just both. Yeah, I started, like, I was always kind of writerly, and so I started writing a little bit for some of the, like, publications that were going around for, this is, like, pre-Facebook. At the time, like, newsletters that people would make, and then started contributing to, like, I've kind of met people who did Lonely Planet writing, and I would like write the like gay column for a certain city at some point in Tokyo. Or I guess by the time I got to Tokyo, I got the job at the newspaper, which was pretty fortuitous. Like, I didn't even really know what copy editing was until I already was like in line to work there.
For anyone on CITR, thanks so much for tuning in. That's the end of our time slot, but you can hear the full episode along with other podcasts on cavegoblins.com. For anyone else, stick around. We've still got lots more to talk about with Jackie.